So that this afternoon's guest is Lou Harry. He's a stand-up comic and writer whose celebrity in Indianapolis is based largely on his work as an editor of Indie Men's Magazine. His body of work includes a number of novelty items. He wrote the books that accompany popular gifts like the Mini Therapist in a Box Kit, as well as the Murder Mystery Party. His more recent work includes a recently published novel entitled The High Impact Infidelity Diet. The film writes at this humorous look at weight loss and sex were recently picked up by Warner Brothers. But today we're discussing In the Can, the greatest career missteps, sophomore slumps, what were they thinking decisions, and fire agent moves in the history of the movies. Good afternoon, Mr. Harry.
Good afternoon, and thank you for getting through that complete title. I know it's a mouthful.
Well, that was the one thing I managed to get through without stumbling. This book covers nearly 100 famous actors and actresses in films that these folks thought for some reason would be favored by fans and critics, and they were neither. Tell me how you came across this idea. Were you just searching for some kind of bad film book, or did you look for this trend right away and come up with a lot of big names?
Well, I've been a movie fan for a long time and was a film student in college. I've reviewed films and things like that. I used to run a film series back at Temple University. And every once in a while, we would put on a bad film festival. And we'd look at some films that really tanked. And half the time, those were as much fun, if not more fun, than the other feature films we were showing. That kind of stayed in my hind brain for a long time. And in trying to figure out a way to channel some of that film interest into a book, I realized there have been books about the worst films ever made and that sort of thing. But very few looking at individual careers and saying, you know, why did this actor make this movie? How does this weird blip appear in the schedule of or in the resume of certain of our best actors? And we decided that the criteria for this book for each actor was going to be to find one film that was not only a box office flop but also a critical flop. It had to be both of those two, and it had to take place after the star was a bona fide star. It couldn't be just some youthful indiscretion.
Did it surprise you that you came up with such a phenomenal list of you know, names and prominently, you know, pretty talented people that have made such, you know, disasters?
Right. Well, we've tried to cover just about every name above the title star who has at least some significant body of work. We focused on living contemporary actors, although we do have sidebars, kind of sections in the back on such things as, you know, classic actors who made that last mistaken film before they passed away, where the last item on their resume isn't their most impressive.
Now, you had to sit through all these. I mean, you may have seen some of them already, but I assume you may have gone back and looked at videos of these films because you described the plots pretty well and put a lot of research and watched, I assume, a lot of really bad movies.
We watched every film in the book. My co-writer and I took about three-quarters of them, and he took the rest. There were a few that we had seen enough times to be able to recall, but most we had to revisit just to try to figure out why. And what exactly, not necessarily just why, but what made this such a bad move? And, of course, hindsight is 20/20. You know, at the time, anything could seem like a pretty good idea.
Are there movies in here that aren't given due justice that, hey, this wasn't that bad, maybe now that you gave it a second look?
Well, some of it is, you know, a matter of some perspective. I mean, Ishtar, the Warren Beatty, Dustin Hoffman film, was considered such a colossal bomb, and part of that had to do with its budget. For what essentially was a light comedy, the budget was astronomical, and there were rumors of, you know, dozens and dozens and upwards to 100 takes of very simple shots by director Elaine May, and the demands of actors Warren Beatty and Dustin Hoffman. In looking at that film again, the first half of it's a pretty funny movie. It's not a bad movie when you get away from all the hype. It falls apart, but it's certainly not as unwatchable as some of the other films that made the collection.
And these are people that generally have some clout by the time they do this. I mean, I think one that stands out for me is John Travolta, Battlefield Earth.
Yes, Battlefield Earth is the one, although that we had some serious debate about which Travolta film to put in there, because if you charted Travolta's career, there are a lot of peaks and there are a lot of pretty deep valleys. And it seemed like for every sort of cycle in his career, there was at least one truly awful movie. I mean, you know, people remember Grease very well as being hugely successful, but they don't talk too much about the other John Travolta, Olivia Newton-John movie, Two of a Kind, which kind of disappeared pretty badly. People talk about Urban Cowboy and Saturday Night Fever, but they tend to forget about Perfect, which was in 1985 supposedly going to be the next, you know, serious film, you know, where Travolta plays the same kind of character, and that one failed miserably. There was a romantic drama that he did with Lily Tomlin called Moment by Moment that is best left forgotten. So Battlefield Earth was not a shoe-in, although it's a tremendously embarrassing film, and even more embarrassing because he was so committed to it. And the degree of an actor's commitment can also factor in here. The amount that the actor seems to believe that they are making a masterpiece certainly can make a film more embarrassing when it flops.
Now, there are a few instances here where maybe you think maybe the actor got a large took advantage of this. I mean, Halle Berry showed up to the Razzies to accept her award for Catwoman,
and finally seeing Catwoman, I used the excuse of this book to finally see that film. And why I think she was able to do that with her head held high to go to the Razzies was because she is far from the problem in the movie. She's actually okay in the movie, and you know when a film can be that horrible and feature Halle Berry in a cat suit, that's pretty bad. But it has mostly to do with directing, writing, and everything around her. So I think she could comfortably walk in there and accept her award. You know, and I think that's been the conventional wisdom in Hollywood. When you do have a colossal flop, better to acknowledge it and deal with it as such. The same thing happened basically with Ben Affleck and Gigli, the difficult-to-pronounce film he made with Jennifer Lopez. You know, the sooner you acknowledge that it was awful, the easier it is to move along.
And you know, it's not as if any of most of these actors weren't desperate. I mean, Halle Berry was, a year or so removed from her Oscar for Monster's Ball.
Right. Well, actually, we give a whole section in the back of the magazine the back of the book, rather. See, I'm stuck on magazines. In the back of the book to Oscar follow-ups, movies that people made soon after, or movies that were released after someone won an Academy Award, which can be embarrassing. I mean, Mira Sorvino won Best Supporting Actress for Mighty Aphrodite, and shortly thereafter she was chasing giant cockroaches in the movie Mimic, a little bit on the embarrassing side. Roberto Benigni made, you know, won Best Actor for Life is Beautiful, but very quickly hit this huge American bomb, Pinocchio. Did okay in Europe, but tanked here. It's very hard to keep up that level of consistency. Some actors kind of freeze up and don't make a movie for another year or two. The rest of them sometimes have something that has been waiting in the can to be released.
Yeah, I think one of the more depressing sections is the quick wrap-up of some of the directors. I mean, they have made, who have great resumes for a good long time, someone like Hal Ashby in the 70s, and Blake Edwards, perhaps, and they can never recapture that magic. Or maybe they tried, like with Billy Wilder and Buddy Buddy, bring back these, you know, Lemon and Matha. How can you go wrong? And they could not recapture what they did earlier, you know, 10, 20 years earlier.
Yeah, it's kind of a shame. Part of it has to do with Hollywood clout and things like that. But, you know, with an actor, you could almost excuse, well, they were collecting the paycheck on this. And to a certain degree with directors, but when you talk about these auteur directors, when you talk about these directors who have a reputation for really driving and being the artistic vision behind a film project, and then you see what some of the stuff, you know, turns out looking like. I mean, you know, Robert Altman is considered, you know, a great Hollywood director, but really people are considering like every fifth movie because everything else is so below the radar of a tank. I mean, Woody Allen the same way. Woody Allen was gold up to mid-80s maybe with Hannah and Her Sisters, but since then there have been such a huge string of flops that have been completely under the radar, where you even talk to film buffs who wouldn't be able to tell you the last three Woody Allen movies.
Now, does this surprise you? I mean, I'm sure there are a number of movies that you and I both seen that made a whole lot of money that we think are terrible, but
yeah.
That the fact that that so many great actors have at least have one film that nobody wanted to see.
Right. Right, and some of them it's a little harder. I mean, you take an actor like Mel Gibson, whose record was pretty remarkable, because almost any film that critically, I mean, many of his films get critical praise and do well at the box office. The ones that aren't particularly critically praised still seem to do okay. It was very tough to find a Mel Gibson film that qualified for the book. We had to go with an obscure 2001 movie called Million Dollar Hotel that Bono produced, that really went under the radar. But most actors do have them somewhere. Sometimes they're contractually obligated to them. You look at Sandra Bullock, who had to do Speed 2, an incredibly embarrassing sequel that didn't come near the success critically or box office that Speed did. And sometimes we had to take a film's budget into account and things like that. I mean, there are films, a lot of successful movies that made a lot less than, say, Godzilla did. But Godzilla was a huge bomb by virtue of the expectation for its success, that its predecessors from its director, and also the huge budget that was put into it.
And a lot of these don't seem to have had a life on video either, some kind of cult following. I mean, we don't have any Rocky Horror Picture Shows here or something that maybe had a larger following, you know, once it hit the shelf of the video store.
Yeah, there aren't many of them, and there's some things I wish they might have tried had they been, you know, somebody been willing to put a little money into the DVD. I mean, there's a semi-legendary Nick Nolte movie called I'll Do Anything from 1994 that was, the story behind that one was they shot it entirely as a musical. James Brooks directed, who had some clout and was able to put a musical together at that time when nobody was making musicals. After a couple of test screenings, they decided to pull all the songs out of the movie. So all the songs were cut from the film. Now, there seems to be something that would be perfect for DVD, for film buffs, to actually see what this movie was like when it had its songs in there. But usually, you know, when something bombs this badly, if they get a DVD release at all, it's kind of a bare-bones release.
Well, maybe if Nick Nolte and Albert Brooks have a few years without a movie, they can release this one. I don't remember it being all that bad.
It wasn't horrible. It was a little disjointed and kind of, you felt like something's missing, but it's hard to tell whether you feel that way because you know that there was, that they're cutting away just before the song, or just because, you know, there was something sort of missing. No, it was certainly not an unwatchable movie by any stretch. It was certainly a lot easier to take than most Madonna movies.
I know this book is fairly new, but any examples since the book came out that in the last couple of months just...
Nothing comes immediately to mind. Some just made it in under the radar as we were finishing the book. We were, I don't recall offhand which of the Kevin Spacey films we were considering, maybe Life of David Gale, but then Beyond the Sea opened and closed pretty quickly and was such a project built around his, you know, his passion and his, for want of a better word, ego, to make the Bobby Darin story, and the results were so all over the place that we had to go in at the last minute and pay attention to Beyond the Sea.
Well, Lou Harry, I want to thank you so much for joining me. Any final thoughts on what's the worst movie in this book?
The worst is probably Madonna's Step Swept Away, which falls under the heading of, you know, generally if the star's husband is directing, you should stay away from it. But the one thing that I'm left with, people have asked me whether, you know, we hate movies now or whether we think less of movies. Actually, I'm more admiring of movies after having written this book, because if these very, very talented people can fail so badly, it must be really tough to make a good movie. It must be harder than any of us can even imagine. And so when something truly magical does come on screen, I think we admire it even more because of having lived through these other films.
Lou Harry is the co-author of In the Can, The Greatest Career Missteps, Sophomore Slumps, What Were They Thinking Decisions, and Fire Your Agent Moves in the History of Movies. Thanks very much for joining us today.
An absolute pleasure.